Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Please take a moment to like the show on iTunes, if you in fact like it, and please reach out if you have any questions. You can find me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on social media, @thefoodballer. We have one more week left in this season here at Heritage, and then we'll be taking a brief hiatus. The summer season will start back up May 7th, so the first Feast Your Ears in the new season will be May 10th. Today is episode number 69 of Feast Your Ears, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Leah Archibald, who is the executive director of the Evergreen Exchange, North Brooklyn's number one resource for industrial businesses. She's also the lead singer and songwriter for Wide Right, which is, I hope I'm describing it okay, Leah. I would describe Wide Right as a rollicking, anthemic 70s-style rock band.
Sure, rollicking and anthemic.
Yeah. Thanks so much for taking your time out of your day today in the rain. It's suddenly raining today, to join me here in the studio.
I'm really happy to be here.
So tell me a little bit about you. So what does that mean? What is the Evergreen Exchange? Tell me a little bit about sort of how did you come? You've been in this sort of business services organization world for a long time. So tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. So I'll start out with tell you a little bit about what Evergreen is, right? So I run a small nonprofit that works here in North Brooklyn that works with businesses in the industrial neighborhood so that we can help them grow so that we can keep high-quality working-class jobs in our community. So our bottom line is jobs, and particularly working-class jobs, manufacturing predominantly. Why do I do this, right? Well, I'm originally from Buffalo, New York, and, got to witness firsthand the negative effects of deindustrialization.
Sure.
You can have all the beautiful architecture and fabulous world-class museums in a city that you can cram in there, but if there aren't jobs, a city loses its vitality.
Absolutely.
So that's why, I personally am really concerned with jobs. In New York City, there's a lot of effort paid at drawing, the highest paying jobs, i.e. finance, industry, real estate jobs.
Sure.
And I think that the, ones for working class folks, immigrants, people, that have lower levels of educational attainment, they kind of get short shrift. And so that's why I do what I do.
Great. And I think it's important. And I think that, we're sitting right here in an area of some people would call Bushwick, some people call East Williamsburg, that has seen an incredible kind of revitalization, in no small part due to people like Roberta's, where we're sitting right now, who brought kind of, restaurants to this area. But historically, this had been a real industrial neighborhood. Still is. I mean, there's, we have Boar's Head across the street, and Greenfield Clothiers is in the neighborhood, and there's a lot of other places as well, but we've also seen a huge shift. So I think that it's really important that we remember, and I think as you point out, that the vibrancy of the city comes from this intermingling. If all we have, I think of somewhere like the Lower East Side, which I feel like has been losing its vibrancy over the years, as it's lost experimental music venues,
generally,
as it's lost its sort of old school shops that catered to, both Jewish and Puerto Rican families, and it's become sort of this swath of, great restaurants, fun bars, but that's really kind of a one-trick pony.
Right. It's become an entertainment district.
Yep.
Right. So what can we do that balances all of these uses?
Right.
Right. We do a lot, as you mentioned earlier, we do a lot of direct business service. We help businesses one-to-one. We do workshops and seminar series, and then, you know, do one-on-one assistance. But a lot of the work we've been doing in recent years has been kind of more being thought leaders on how we can more adequately balance the competing demands for space in this industrial neighborhood.
Yeah. Do you find that that aspect of the job, is it about helping long-term tenants that have been manufacturing in the area to help them to be able to stay, let's say, when their lease comes up? Or is it about drawing in new? Or what's the balance there?
We don't sweat so much drawing in new. Yeah. We don't have you know firsthand, yeah, how expensive real estate is.
Sure.
Here. We've got really close to a 0% vacancy rate in the industrial neighborhood. So, you know, business attraction isn't really our scene.
Got it.
Business retention is. Helping folks find spaces locally that they can grow into if they're expanding, or helping a business that's growing kind of rethink, for example, their plant layout.
Right.
To optimize the space that they've already got. And more recently, we've been helping people, you know, rethink local planning code, figure out how they can build higher, maybe right, move their offices off the ground floor, move the offices upstairs, and then expand their production on the ground floor. A lot of it, though, is just general overall advocacy,
sure,
to impress upon the decision makers, the powers that be, the chattering class, that it's really worth helping these businesses and keeping these jobs here because, you know, a really significant portion of our city's population depends on them.
Yeah, and I think it's important, and I hope, listeners, that you kind of that the takeaway of this conversation is that there are, and Evergreen's not the only one, that
no,
there are groups like this all over the city, and in fact all over the country, who are doing this kind of, you know, really undercover, almost like, you know, backroom kind of advocacy to really help businesses. And if you are a business owner in the neighborhood and you need help with industrial space, by all means, reach out to Evergreen. But it's also worth just understanding, if you live in the neighborhood, that, you know, the reason that there's no right turn in certain places, or the reason that, you know, streets get changed from one way to two way, a lot of that has to do with the work that Leah does.
Sure. Right out here, as I was walking up, you can't park near the corner over here. Why? So that the gigantic 54-foot trucks can make the turn without smashing your car.
Right.
You know? It's really for your own good.
Right.
It might seem an inconvenience as you're circling looking for a parking spot,
right,
but trust me, it's for your own good.
Yeah.
I've seen it happen.
So have I. And the other thing that happens, of course, is that it snarls traffic when the truck can't make the turn, if they don't hit the car and the car's parked there, and then, you know, nobody wins.
No.
Basically is what happens. And
right,
and it does, you know, it does keep the city, as we said earlier, it does keep it vibrant to maintain this sort of mix of people, and to have people working in a neighborhood. It makes a neighborhood safer if you have people who are there all day and it's not just at night or it's not just during the day. You need to have that kind of mix to keep the city sort of going. I want to switch the conversation a little bit to rock and roll.
Right on. You know. Food and rock and roll are literally two of my favorite subjects.
So you currently lead a band called Wide Right,
yep,
that has been around now for 16 years.
That's a long time.
Congratulations. That's a real feat. And I just wanted to know a little bit about, you know, I know that you have kids. You have a son and a daughter, 17 and 20, I believe, right? And but you started the band when they were little.
Yes.
And you had a full-time job. And so, I mean, I was
in grad school.
And you were, and I didn't even know that part.
Yeah.
You were in grad school. So, you know, I wonder if you have any lessons learned from that. I mean, I had a number of bands before my kids were born. Since my kids were born, I've sort of stopped playing music altogether because I just don't have a lot of time for it. Moxie just started playing flute. So, we play a little bit together, but it's not quite the same. But I can't quite imagine adding the rehearsals, the songwriting, the performing on top of everything I do now. So what led you to do that in the midst of all these other things going on?
Mom needed a little time for herself, basically.
Yeah,
you
sure
know, really, because that was for me,
mm-hmm,
right? And not at the service of anyone else. right? So, but you know, you can cram a surprising amount of stuff in while, like, you know, your children are absentmindedly watching Disney movies on TV.
As I well know. I mean, I wrote all these interview questions this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same format.
I mean, I would just sit there. They would watch whatever, and I'd be like picking away at the guitar. I did a lot of lyric writing, like on the subway.
Yeah.
You know, but also, you know, I would also, I don't think my children or husband would say I was an absentee parent, right. You know, a lot, again, you put the kids to bed at 8:30, a lot can happen after.
Sure.
You know, go to rehearsal or, you know, in the evening or, you know, on the weekend afternoon, you know, it worked. And then of course gigs are at night and late. You can still serve them dinner.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure. Did your kids come with you to rehearsals, or were they kind of like, you know,
they're still, it's shocking, frankly, you know, how little they care about my music. You know, Sam occasionally would be like, how many songs have you written about me? I'm like, well, I told him there's a few songs he's mentioned in, you know, but, and that's like the extent of his interest. Kira could care less. Yeah. She was home last summer from college, and I was like, you know what, Kira, you know, Dave Rick, the other guitarist in the band's daughter, Sophie, who Kira's friends with, is coming to our gig. Why don't you come? Sophie's going to be there. You know, come see mom play, right? And she like came for like two songs, and I'm standing there, I'm playing and I'm watching. I'm like, just ghosted. Right. See you later, Mom. They could care less.
Right.
You know?
Gosh, what if you did that to them when they had a school performance? If you just like got up in the middle and walked out.
Totally. They might, at this point, they might understand. I mean, as we speak right now, my son is pitching a baseball game in Washington Heights, you know, but he understood it. Okay, Mom. Because I'm going to see him 70 other times this summer.
Of course. And also they're older now. I mean, they're adults essentially. So it's a little bit different.
When they were little, they were, for a fleeting instant, Kira was interested in it, in as much as it reminded her of the White Stripes.
Sure.
You know, and I actually managed to get her into a White Stripes show, and she was wearing like the whole Meg White outfit, and she got to like talk to them after the gig. And
cool.
So that's probably the beginning and end of any currency that I possess. Yeah. With my daughter.
Well, I will say that one of the things I really like about the music, having grown up, you know, listening to classic rock, which is, you know, was at the, I feel like at the time was a way we referred to a time period, but really is a genre of music. One of the things I always liked about it is that it was, you know, it was self-referential about kind of activities and events, often about rock and roll, about going to the shows, about performing, about being on the bus, about being on tour, all those things. And a lot of your songs, I like that they're about you and your life, and they're about going to work, and they're about the boss, and they're about kids, and they're about, you know, how do you deal with all of these sort of things of being an adult.
Totally. Right?
And then, but you're singing about it, and it's something I think that lots of people can really connect with.
I would think so. You know, it's like, you know, married middle-aged lady rock. Yeah. You know, but you know, certainly more people can relate to having a crappy boss than, say, you know, the angst of the tour bus.
Right.
Right. I would think it's a more universal situation.
Yeah. Yeah, you know. I mean, that was always one of the things that I sort of always thought was funny about those things is like, oh, yeah, your life is so hard. You know, I mean, you know, we all have the problems we have, right? I mean, that's, you know, sort of how life works. But do you have any gigs coming up?
Yeah, I think we're actually going to play one here in North Brooklyn. I believe it's over Memorial Day weekend. It's the Saturday, I guess, the 27th at the Gutter.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
And now the band is a three-piece? Is that right?
We are a four-piece.
Four-piece. Got it.
Yeah, I sing and play rhythm guitar. My friend Dave Rick plays bass. He started out in the band playing lead guitar, but he's really, really, really picky about the bass stylings for the music, and like all of our bassists kind of shuddered underneath his personality. So finally, he just like
he's played bass.
Took
playing
matters
bass,
in
right,
his,
yeah.
right. He so now he plays bass, and his wife plays lead guitar, Colette Russin, and our longtime drummer, the one I started the band with, moved to Boston last year to take a real grown-up person's job. So we have a new drummer, which
cool.
I'm really, really excited about. I'm just, I'm excited to get kind of get it rolling again.
Yeah. Awesome. That's great. And it sounds like you have even hopefully a little even more time if the kids are kind of off in college, Kira's in college. And
that's the, that's my thought is like, my son is only going to be around for another year and then I'm empty nest.
Right.
Like you might as well fill it with rock and roll.
Yeah, absolutely.
You might as well.
That's great. Yeah. So keep that in mind, everybody. When fill your empty nest with rock and roll. That's the quote of the show.
That's right. It's right up there with have a good time all the time.
Yeah.
My other favorite saying.
We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about what you just said about have a good time all the time.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and today in the studio I have Leah Archibald from Evergreen Exchange and also the lead singer and songwriter of Wide Right. So before the break, we were sitting here behind Roberta's and we were talking about happiness and empty nest and things like that. And one of the things I had wanted to bring up with Leah and I have known each other for a long time, and every time I see Leah, she's smiling. And Leah, you always seem to be happy. And I want to talk about that because many people that I know, whether it's in their life or their relationship, I feel like people in general are not happy. And we live in this sort of world where there's the rat race of New York and you're sort of being ground up by the cogs of, of the world and of industry and of your life. And you always seem to be really happy. And I'm interested to know sort of about that. You seem very happy with your work.
I am. I'm actually really psyched. Like I really like the work I do. I feel like I'm employing my skills and personality to make a difference where it matters. And I can see, over the years, there are everywhere I go in industrial Brooklyn, I helped that guy or we helped this.
Right.
Like you can see people you've helped. I remember it all. So you feel like you're making a difference in other people's lives. And of course, by extension, helping keep more job opportunities in the neighborhood. So that makes me feel really effective. I've been really fortunate, but mostly I'm a bit of a simpleton. I mean, like flat out, I'm like I'm really as perceived, I'm kind of that. I'm not, there's no, tumultuous inner personality.
Sure.
I'm not conflicted about anything. I easily forgive myself. And I think like that's actually really meaningful to give yourself a break.
Yeah, sure.
I do my best. Yeah. And I call it a day at the end of the day. Yep. I'm not perfect.
Yep.
And so I think that a lot of people's inner turmoil is, you know, this discrepancy between the bar they've set for themselves and yep. their perception of yep. how they're getting there. Me, I'm like, I tried.
Yeah.
You know. But, you know, I've got, I got a lot of friends. You know, my kids are turning out all right.
Yeah, right.
You know, but it could have been like, but you know, the other thing is like, it could have not gone that way, right? Yeah. You know, I don't know if you know, my daughter was gravely ill as an infant, and you know, she like it could have not turned out so great.
Yeah,
right. She was hospitalized for a year, wow. and you know, we had at least one near death experience. And she ended up being okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, like, I'm going to say I was probably... But the truth of the matter is, like, because I'm really built the way I'm built, I was pretty happy then, too, sure. even going through all that, yeah. you know, BS. You know, it's... Yeah. Go easy on yourself. And in the words of the immortal Viv Savage, have a good time all the time.
What do you love most about working with the businesses that you get to work with?
There's a lot I like about it. It's fun to meet people. Yeah. It's, you know, like there are people like me get a charge out of serving, mm-hmm. right? If I didn't do this, I'd be serving in some other way. You know, I like to help people. I like to help my friends. You can ask all of them. You know, like I'm like the advice lady, and yep. you know, so it suits my personality, so I guess that would be it. Like just kind of being able to serve, yeah. and then you know, being able to see the results of
are
their
there
successes.
Any, are there any recent projects in North Brooklyn with specific businesses that you've helped them sort of achieve something that you're really proud of?
I can't think off the top of my head an individual business. I think in recent years, a lot of my own energy is going toward this bigger ticket advocacy that is not really for one business, but yeah. like to benefit the business community as a whole. And that's probably where I've seen my biggest successes. So I think the... You know, the fact that there was such raucous public debate about the potential rezoning in Greenpoint Williamsburg around the buildings at 25 Kent.
Yep.
And that would probably be the I'd put that on the greatest hits
sure.
list. Not that we got everything we wanted.
Right.
We barely got any of what we wanted, yep. but... It got attention and it got talked about, and really my goal is to just continue to keep the issues of manufacturers and working class jobs in the public discourse.
Sure.
So that's on the greatest hits list.
Yeah. One program of Evergreen's that I want to make sure I mention is the Small Food Producers Network, which is a fantastic resource for anyone out there who has a small food business, is thinking of starting a small food business, who wants to manufacture their food here in Brooklyn and especially in North Brooklyn. Can you tell me just a little bit, speak a little bit about that program?
Yeah, we are really proud of it. This is something that... I guess it must be like 5 or 6 years ago, you know, we kind of invented. We're like, hey, there's a lot of small food manufacturers here. We should do something special just for them. And, you know, it attracted a little bit of foundation funding. And so we started these monthly meetups that you guys have generously hosted at the Brooklyn Kitchen. And you know, we make sure that only small food manufacturers are in attendance, so that it cuts down on a lot of, like, you know, the suits and the service guys yep. that are preying on businesses. So it feels,
and helping, you know.
But it feels like more of a community yep. for and by them, and that's really been an important component of the success. But we've been able to grow that programming, you know, funders have really latched on, and we just got a gigantic grant from the J.P. Morgan Chase Foundation to majorly expand it. So we've got kind of three tiers of programming. We've got the at the lowest level, the easiest way to get in is we've got these monthly meetups. They're, you know, panel discussions. It's informative. There's networking, and then the next tier up is we've got these workshop series, right? You know, so it's, you know, a 5-week long human resource boot camp where you enroll and you come out with an HR manual, or, you know, QuickBooks for your small business, or inventory management. And then the top tier of that is this executive peer learning cohort. So this is a really in-depth for just a small number of businesses, kind of our highest functioning ones, to meet once every month with a professional business coach and facilitator to get one-on-one coaching, but to do this peer work to help them, you know, examine the challenges in their own businesses and get both professional and peer advice. And we provide this totally free of charge. This is for one of those businesses to be in a similar thing with Vistage, who is the organization we're doing this with, would cost them $1,200 a month each person.
Yep.
And we offer it to these guys, you know, for free. We've raised that money. So we are I'm hugely proud. We've been able to serve, you know, dozens and dozens, like over, you know, a couple hundred businesses over, since the inception. And I'm kind of so psyched about that we're going to try and replicate that for design, fabrication, build businesses. Because we've got a lot of artisan, metal, wood, textile fabricators. Yeah. So we're going to, that next up is expand that programming for those artisan subsectors.
I think that's great because, I mean, one of the things, certainly having grown the Brooklyn Kitchen over the last 10 years, you know, you start out, and in many cases, not everybody, but you start out and you kind of think you have a good idea and you bootstrap it and you start, but you don't really know anything. And, you know, lots of these people, I mean, what I have found, at least in the food business, but I think the same thing is true in design businesses and in fabrication businesses, you know, you start with what you're good at. But usually that means what you're good at is making things out of metal.
Totally.
It doesn't mean that what you're good at is doing HR when you suddenly have 10 employees.
Totally.
Or, you know, how do you make sure that your record keeping is up to date or your invoicing
your
is correct.
You receive
all of the managing, you know, managing debt, taking on loans, not taking on loans, all of those things. You know, you started out because you were good at being a metal worker or you were good at making jam or you were good at making, you know, charcuterie or, you know, or whatever it is. And then suddenly you find yourself having to run a business, which is a whole different thing.
Right. And so we're not, you know, we're not talking with folks about design or how to package materials or whatever. It's really about, you know, building business skills. And particularly with that executive peer learning cohort, the idea is to take business owners and turn them into CEOs.
Yep.
You know, so that's really where our sweet spot is. And there aren't that many other places folks can get this tutelage.
Yep.
And for free.
Yeah.
Frankly, I raise all the money.
Right. And you know? And having taken part in some of this, both through Evergreen and through some of these other organizations like this in the city, I can tell you that it's totally worth it. And that one of the best things I think that comes out of it is not just access to the people who are the speakers in these meetings and at the panels or if you are part of one of these cohorts, but is the relationship that you then build with other business owners in the neighborhood and about, you know, the dumbest things. I mean, your roll down gate breaks and who do you call? Do you call the guy who put the sticker on your thing or do you, you know, so, I mean, this happened to us a couple months ago where our roll down gate broke. And the first thing I did was text the two other business owners I knew who have roll down gates. And I said, hey, do you have a guy? And they had a guy and he showed up and he fixed it and was reasonable. And, you know, so even just having that kind of an informal network of people is invaluable.
Yeah. Part of we've been in existence for, you know, over 35 years. And I think part of the value that we bring is creating the sense of community that people can plug into when they need it. You know, because folks, they're in their business, they're doing their thing, whatever. They show up, they go home, parent-teacher conferences, whatever. That's their life. But you can plug into our events or just by calling us or emailing us and it reminds you you're part of something bigger and there's more, there's more people just like you with the same challenges out there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to be a food business to want to figure out how you get, you know, your trash collection to be better. Or, you know, like we, lots of businesses in New York have all the same problems, even if your businesses are totally different.
Totally.
So there's a lot of value there as well. I wanted to touch briefly. One of my questions that I ask all my guests is about the first thing they ever learned to cook. And your note really struck me, which is that the first thing you learned to cook was tuna melt. In home ec class.
In home ec.
Which you know, I want to know that, you know, you say that, you know, nobody should ever heat mayo, and the tuna melt is kind of not, I'm guessing that's not something that appears in your own kitchen very often.
Ever.
But what I'm curious to know, as someone who, you know, I had a very small amount of home ec when I was in school. It sounds like it was a little bit similar to yours. You could choose a different path. And so I actually did more sort of like marine biology, and then we also had an auto shop at my high school. I didn't really do a lot of the cooking stuff. I did a lot of cooking at home with my mom and my grandmother. Did you learn anything in the cooking home ec, or was it really
I learned that what most people call a spatula is really a rubber scraper. That's one of the key things I recall from eighth grade home ec. So in my school, it was a little different. Boys took shop, girls took home ec, right? So girls were not allowed to take shop. And I already knew how to sew. In fact, like, I had taken private sewing lessons as a young kid, and I was sewing, you know, garments that were significantly more complex than I would sew right now.
Sure.
Right? Lots of interfacing and, you know, all this hand-sewn stuff. So I was like,
you could go work for Martin if you
totally. I could hand sew a buttonhole if I needed to. And you know, the sewing projects for that class were stupid. It was like, you know, make a kerchief for your hair or something dumb like that, an apron. And so I'm like, I'm not taking that. And I petitioned the school to get out of sewing to take industrial arts. And they weren't going to let me, and my folks backed me up, and, like, they let me take electronics class. However, I could not get out of the food module, the cooking, because my mother was like, you gotta learn how to cook sometime.
Right.
So she compelled me to take that one, but I did get out of the sewing module.
And what about your kids? Have they taken any of that? It doesn't exist in school anymore, right?
No. They both can hum a few bars. Right. You know, if there's, you know, Sam is a champion quesadilla maker,
yeah, sure,
and has been for many years.
Yep.
He'll make little inventions of, you know, Kira, you know, she does fine.
Yeah.
If she's got like eggs and rice and something, like she's building a repertoire.
Yeah, of course.
They're not going to starve.
No, of course. And that's the goal at that point, right?
Yeah.
Is to not starve. I remember when I went to college, I was one of, you know, there were 10 roommates. We all lived in a house together. And I think there were like 3 of us who knew how to cook. And everybody else, you know, ate bagels and mac and cheese, and that was like it.
Totally.
That was all. They could toast a bagel and spread peanut butter on it, but that was kind of it. And then there were the others of us who, like, actually were trying to figure out how to cook, and, you know, could we cook rice? Like, what was that about? And, like,
how do we do that? When I was in college, the first experience I had, like, cooking with a friend was I was visiting her at the house she lived in, and she was making a stir fry. And she took broccoli out of the refrigerator, like in a head,
yeah,
actual broccoli. And it was like she taught me how to make a stir fry, but I was literally marveling. You mean it doesn't come in a frozen block? Right. Like, I had no idea,
yeah,
like that you could get things that weren't iceberg lettuce and tomatoes fresh.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Well, I mean, you know, we're seeing we continue to see, I think, I don't know if they knew they were in the Renaissance, like when the Renaissance happened, right? We talk about it now, but I feel like we're in it now with food for sure. And, you know, I mean, my kids are growing up, you know, knowing what ramps are and, you know, loving to eat mushrooms. When we go to the farmer's market, Moxie wants to buy the, you know, different color oyster mushrooms, and she knows what those are. And I'm really interested to see what that looks like 15 years down the line. What is their experience like?
It's going, and they'll be much more adventurous eaters.
Yeah.
You know, my son in particular, he's a generally risk-averse dude. doesn't like roller coasters or being jostled or anything. But he approaches food from the viewpoint of this must be good rather than I don't know if this is good.
Yeah.
You know, so he assumes anything someone's going to put in front of him is good.
Sure, because some effort went into it and they made it for him.
And they're, you know, and even Kira, who's not such an adventurous eater, but she did a semester abroad in Europe. Man, she really tried.
Yeah.
I watched her. She ate everything. She tried. So I got to give her that.
So as a musician who's spent some time playing around in the city, do you have a favorite venue to perform in, either that's still around or not?
That's the thing. You know, we had this like 5-year hiatus, so we were gigging a lot, you know, at like Southpaw, Mercury Lounge, you know, kind of those. So like I would have to say Southpaw would have been my absolute favorite. I mean, we were friends with the owners, friends with the bar staff, friends with the sound guys.
Yeah.
You know, it was, I like literally, I could just leave my gear there and go out drinking and take the B63 bus home and just go get it the next day.
Right.
You know, so it was like, it was a real home base.
Yeah.
So I you know, I miss that. You know, now in, you know, Mach 2, Mach Tiny, where, you know, like it used to be like we could, you know, get a really good crowd in a large, in a venue that size. Now I'm like hoping for 30 people at Hank's.
Yeah.
You know, so now Hank's.
Sure.
I've downsized.
Yeah.
You know.
That's good. You know, it may grow again, right? I mean, that's, you know, it takes, as a working musician, you have to build that following, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard and it's different now. Yeah. And it's not, you know, I'm not getting any younger, which means that my friends aren't getting any younger, which means the people who want to hear more stories about taking your son to baseball games, you know, or, you know, the middle-aged things I sing about are not like so resonant to the sorts of people that go out a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Got it.
That was my problem the first time around too.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite spot for a late night snack after you play?
Yes, I do. I'm not much of a midnight snacker.
Sure.
Like, I, you know, I'm always trying to watch my weight. So, like, after dinner, I'm, like, done. But my favorite thing, like, literally, my favorite thing in life, if I had to list, like, narrow it down to 5 or 10 things, late night slice. There's a, you know, a regular pizza place, Joe's Pizza on Fifth Avenue. It's near my house. It's open late. So like late night slice, just standing down there, standing on the sidewalk by myself, eating late night slice. That's like the best. it's like meditative. It's fabulous.
Awesome. One last sort of question about something that I guess is not exactly related to Evergreen, but I recently found out that there's a group that is advocating to rename the Williamsburg Bridge the Sonny Rollins Bridge.
Really?
And I wanted to know if you knew about that.
No.
So the story is that Sonny Rollins took a hiatus from 1959 to 1961 and lived at 400 Grand Street in Manhattan. And almost every day for 2 years played for hours at the center of the span of the Williamsburg
Really?
Bridge.
I didn't know that.
And apparently there was an article in The New Yorker by Amanda Petrusich recently, and it had to do with the fact he was so prolific. He released like 21 albums in like 7 years in the 50s, and felt like there were all these new guys, Ornette Coleman and John Coltrane, who were coming in with kind of a new thing, sort of, you know, more avant-garde free jazz stuff. And he felt like he just sort of needed to like be gone from the scene and just focus on his music. And his wife supported them. She had a secretarial job, and every day for 2 years he played in the middle of the bridge.
That's crazy. I've never heard that.
Yeah, which is very cool. And so, I mean, I definitely, be really, you know, be an interesting nod, I think, for the city to do that. Even if it was just in the same way that like streets have a name after a person,
right,
it's still
totally.
9th Street, but it's, you know, Tara Shevchenko, and that's not 9th Street, but what, you know, somebody's street name, right?
Yeah, or, you know, like they did with the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, the Ari Halberstram on-ramp.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
There's something.
Yeah, maybe the pedestrian pathway could be like the Sonny Rollins pedestrian pathway or something.
There's a million ways to slice that up. Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
That's a really cool story.
Do you have anything else you want to bring up? Is there anything coming up with Evergreen or the Small Food Producers Network or Wide Right that you want to mention before we finish up?
Let's see. I'll start with Wide Right. It's my fervent hope that we've got about a dozen songs that haven't been recorded yet. I hope to write a few more and then get into the studio for the first time in really a long time. That would be exciting and a good use of my empty nestness.
Yes, sure.
With Small Food Producers Network, we are working on our next slate of workshops. Come... If you're interested, our website, evergreenexchange.org. Keep checking it, and as soon as we finalize dates and themes, it will be up on the website. And then, with Evergreen, our big ticket, we've got our annual fundraiser coming up, and that's an all-hands-on-deck moment for our organization. But it's really to fundraise for that event is really important. It's at the Brooklyn Winery. A local cool. manufacturer.
Yep.
All that advocacy that we pour all this energy into, nobody gives us any money for that.
Right.
The only way that we're free to spend staff time doing that is from the money we raise through our fundraiser and through membership. So it's a pretty important activity for us, and it lets us do all the stuff that we believe to be right that no one gets behind financially.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Leah, for joining me today. You can find more information about Wide Right at widerightmusic.com and evergreenexchange.org has all the information you need about Evergreen. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. A big thank you to David Tatasciore, who engineers this show every Wednesday. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me on Instagram, @TheFoodBaller. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.